Okay, welcome to the Soul Pen Writers Aloud Literary Reading, which is co-sponsored by Penn, the Sandergeld Chapter of Penn International, and the online, soon to be in paperback, literary magazine Soul English Writing in Mexico. I'm going to tell you a little bit about both of these entities. Sandergeld Penn is part of Penn International, the largest... Do I hear someone talking? Whoever it is, please stop talking. You can tell that I'm a teacher, right? The largest worldwide association of writers with 145 centers in 104 countries, promoting friendship and intellectual cooperation among writers everywhere, fighting for freedom of expression and representing the conscience of world literature. The Sandergeld Center celebrated its 30th anniversary in 2009. During those 30 years, and continuing to this day, the local chapter advocated through letters, personal appeals, and organized protests, such as its reading in February of Wild Pigeon, a short story which has landed its Uyghur minority author a 3-year jail sentence in China. There were wild pigeon events all over the world. More recently, Penn participated in a reading in solidarity with Burmese writers, and I'm sure that there were a few other centers that had something to do with it. But shortly after our reading, many of those imprisoned poets were set free. Okay, Soul English Writing in Mexico. Activities that Penn does, and I want you to know that you don't have to be a writer to join International Penn and to help with this important work in the world. You can join as an associate and be part of our organization here in Santa Gilda Allende. Okay, Soul English Writing in Mexico is a little deceiving in its title because we have three categories that we accept poetry, nonfiction, and fiction in. One is writing from people in Mexico who are writing in English. The second category is writing about English. But when his co-founder Bill Perlman and I were thinking about what we wanted to have in the magazine, we decided to come up with a third category, which is called We Like It. Okay? So if you're thinking of submitting to Soul English Writing in Mexico, and have something that isn't written in or based in Mexico, please do, because we'd like to see it. We're coming out now twice a year. The next issue will be mid-March. Judith Hill will be sending around a little sign-up sheet. If you're not already one of our subscribers, we can get you on so that you automatically get a copy of the magazine, and it's free. The profit from these readings go to the San Miguel Chapter Penn's scholarship fund for at-risk children. And of course, even the 35 peso drink credit that you got goes to scholarships for children through the Biblioteca. So truly, by coming to these readings, you're helping out kids who need an education in Mexico. We've got a couple of the Penn officers here, and I'd like them to stand up. I know Luciana Kaufman is the secretary. Okay. Let's see if I'm going to say it right. Elizabeth Starshevich, is that right? Our president of Penn. Last night, when I introduced her at her lecture, I called her the president of all San Miguel, and that might not be a bad idea, but she is our local PEN president. Okay, I'd also like to read off the names of the editors of Sol English Writing in Mexico, and I'll do it all at once. And would you please stand up? Laura Julia Wood, Anne Nicolai, David Barrow, Bill Perlman, James Cervantes, Carolyn Roberts, she's in Australia, Judith Hill, I know is here somewhere. Okay, and I'm Eva Hunter, I'm the executive editor of Sol English Writing in Mexico. Our first reader today will be Gerard Helfferich. Jerry is a former senior editor at what we now call the Legacy Presses, which I think is kind of an interesting name for the big established presses. But a few years ago, he decided he was going to start writing. And so far, he's written three nonfiction books, all of which have been highly reviewed: Humboldt's Cosmos, High Cotton, Stone of Kings, which is his brand new book, and he's now beginning work on a book about an assassination attempt on the life of President Theodore Roosevelt. Jerry's been in many of our readings. We're always happy to have him. And we also have an excerpt from Stone of Kings in the online edition of Sol, which is up right now. So I'm really very thrilled to introduce to you Gerard Helfferich.
Thank you very much, Eva. This is the book I'm going to be reading from, Stone of Kings. It's actually a sold copy, so let me give it back to the owner, but I wanted to just hold it up so you could take a look at it. The man in San Miguel has been greater than I expected, and I've sold all the copies that I have here, but I do have copies of Humboldt's Cosmos and High Cotton to sign in South Africa, in case anyone is interested. When we think of jade, we usually think of China, but in fact, jade, to ancient people in Mesoamerica like the Maya and the Olmec and the Aztec, jade was literally the most valuable substance that they knew. For years, they used it to adorn their kings, for millennia, I should say. They used it to adorn their kings. They used it to trade, to make jewelry, masks. Then the Spanish arrived in Mexico, as we know, in 1519, and the Spanish couldn't care less about jade. They were only interested in gold and silver. So within 50 years of the Spanish conquest, the sources of Maya jade were literally lost. No one knew where they had gotten the raw stone that they used to carve all these fabulous objects. In the 19th century, when archaeologists started uncovering Mayan cities such as Palenque and Chichen Itza, they discovered some of these fabulous carved objects. But again, no one knew where the stone had come from. It wasn't until the 20th century, the 1950s, and especially the 1970s, when the mystery started to be solved. So Stone of Kings is the story of this 400-year mystery of where the Mayas, and the Olmecs and their neighbors got their jade. Part of it is the story of the stone itself. It talks about how jade is formed, how it's made into beautiful objects once it's taken from the ground. Part of the story has to do with the Maya and the other people and what jade meant to them. Part of the story is the 19th century archaeologists who made these discoveries in the ancient cities. And part of the story, as we shall see, has to do with 20th century prospectors, including one of whom has roots in San Miguel. So I'm going to read two short passages. The first one is the historical side of the book. It's about Edward Herbert Thompson, who dredged the cenote the sacred cenote at Chichen Itza and discovered the most, what's been called the most valuable, the most amazing, really, archaeological cache that's ever been discovered in the Americas. This is from the first chapter of the book. Yucatan, 1909. The middle-aged man was sweating inside his canvas diving suit. Peering through the helmet's tiny faceplate, he saw the tropical foliage spilling over the limestone walls of the cenote. At the other end of the pontoon, the Indian crew was working the pumps, and he felt the rhythmic puffs of oily air wafting into his helmet. Lumbering to the ladder, he carefully adjusted his speaking tube, lifeline, and air hose, their cork bottle floats tied at intervals like so many crystal beads. Then, one by one, the workers approached, peered into his clear blue eyes, and offered a solemn handshake, as though expecting never to see him again. Chichen Itza's sacred well was dark and still as an obsidian mirror. The diver released his grip on the ladder and felt cool water envelop him. Weighted down by the copper helmet, the lead bars across his chest, the iron-soled boots, he began to drop. There was a searing pain in his ears, and he reached for the valve on either side of his helmet. A hiss, and the pressure subsided. Drifting through the murk, he imagined himself as weightless as one of the silvery bubbles arcing to the surface. Within the first 10 feet, the scant sunlight faded from yellow to green to nearly black. He took out his submarine flashlight. There were 30 feet of water in the sacred well, and beneath that, an unfathomable layer of muck, masking the secrets of centuries. Not far from the cenote's sheer wall, the dredge had opened an underwater pit 18 feet deep, its flanks studded with stone columns and blocks. As he floated past, one of the stones toppled into the darkness, loosing a shockwave that sent him tumbling. Struggling to right himself, he felt as tremulous as an egg white in a glass of water. Then a strange thrill came over him when he realized that he was the only creature who had ever come here with any expectation of leaving alive. The local people said that huge snakes and horrific monsters prowled the depths of the sacred well, guarding the entrance to Xibalba, the underworld that Maya kings and shamans sought to penetrate in their ecstatic trances. In 1904, when the workers were beginning to dredge, a wise man from the village had pointed to a spot beneath the water and told him, "There is where the palace of the rain god lies." Now bounding across the mud in that direction, the diver found a deep natural depression. Through the gloom, he made out a whitish smudge on the hollow's edge. Then as he drew closer, he saw that it was a row of bones, not of jaguars or deer, but of human beings, three women stretched out in the silt as though dozing in their hammocks. The cool, dark water had preserved fragments of their plain woven cotton dresses, and around the neck of one were draped exquisite pendants of carved jade, their facets as crisp and lustrous as the day they were cast into the sacred well. Edward Herbert Thompson had been obsessed with the ruined city of Chichen Itza for decades, especially with the sacred cenote and the grisly rites that supposedly had taken place there. For 30 years, Thompson had dreamed of exploring the sacred cenote and testing these rumors of human sacrifice. It was a blistering April day when Thompson finally saw the ancient city. Climbing a winding path, threading his way past enormous boulders and tall trees, he was reminded of forest trails he had known in New England. Then he realized that the massive blocks he passed were intricately chiseled into columns and pillars. As he began to grasp that the forest floor was actually an ancient terrace, he peered through the trees and glimpsed an ash-colored mass shimmering in the sun. He recognized it from photographs, Chichen Itza's great limestone pyramid, 75 feet tall, stepped and square, and surmounted by a temple. In the woods beyond, verdant knobs jutted from the canopy, more decrepit temples and palaces waiting to be unearthed. The sense of antiquity was overwhelming. Old and cold, he wrote, furrowed by time, haggard, imposing, and impressive, they rear their rugged masses above the surrounding level and are beyond description. When he returned to the States for a scientific conference, Thomas seized his opportunity. In Boston, he petitioned the Peabody and the American Antiquarian Society for a dredge, winch, tackle, ropes, steel cables, and a derrick with a 30-foot swinging boom. He also took diving lessons. Learning of his plan, his friends objected that no one could descend into the sacred well and expect to come out alive. Thompson was fit and blessed with a rugged constitution, but he was nearly 50 years old. If he wanted to commit suicide, they asked, couldn't he find a less spectacular means? But in the end, his patrons agreed to finance the scheme, dredge, diving suit, and all. For weeks, Thompson sat at the edge of the sacred well, musing and calculating, taking measurements and soundings. Perched on a stone ruin above the cenote's rim, he heaved in logs weighing as much as an average native to gauge where sacrificial victims would have landed. Christening this the Fertile Zone, he resolved to start work there. On March 5, 1904, Thompson began dredging. Standing on the planked platform in his tall rubber boots and broad-brimmed hat, he felt an inexpressible thrill as the steel jaws swung out, hung in space, then plunged into the dark water of the sacred well. The four workers strained over the winch handles. The cable tautened. Water boiled. Then the bucket broke the surface and dripping rose to the cenote's edge. The workers positioned the wooden boom over the platform and a carload of dark brown matter spewed out, decayed wood, leaves, and mostly mud. For days it was the same, the dredge working up and down, raising muck and rocks, muck, more muck. Once his teeth gripped an entire tree trunk, which disintegrated on the platform during the next 2 days, leaving only a ghostly stain. Another time, the dredge raised the commingled bones of a jaguar and a deer, and there were dozens of potsherds. These tantalized Thompson, who wanted to believe them evidence of some sacred, of some ancient ritual, but in the end, he found them unpersuasive. Boys are boys everywhere, he figured, and a boy's instinct is to skip flat objects across smooth water. When no other artifacts were found, Thompson began to regret exposing his patrons in Massachusetts to so much expense and himself to so much ridicule. By day, he became increasingly nervous, by night, sleepless. One morning, he arose from yet another bout of insomnia. The day was as dark as his thoughts, and tracing the path from his house, past the Great Pyramid and down the processional causeway leading to the cenote, he plodded toward the staccato clicks of the dredge's break. Taking his position under the palm leaf lean-to, he watched the men working the winches. Slowly, the bucket emerged from the water and pivoted over the platform as it had hundreds of times before. But as he glanced listlessly into the metal jaws, Thompson spied two yellowish globular masses nestled in the chocolate muck. Reaching into the basket, he hefted the objects and saw that they seemed to be made of resin, which he confirmed by pinching off a bit and tasting it. There were some lighted embers nearby, and when he tossed a piece into them, it released a wonderful aroma. He realized he was holding globes of copal incense that had been hurled into the cenote hundreds of years before, during the rituals recorded in the legends. That night, for the first time in weeks, Thompson slept soundly and long. There was hardly a day after that when something astonishing didn't appear in the bucket of Thompson's dredge. Then, after 5 years, when the machine began raising just mud and sticks and slivers of rock, he started to dive. In the end, he recovered nearly 30,000 artifacts from the cenote, a fantastic haul that has been called the single most important archaeological treasure ever recovered in the Americas. The chapter then goes on to describe what he found, but I want to fast forward 170 some odd years. I mentioned that there was a connection to San Miguel. One of the main figures in the book is an archaeologist who's trained, she's American, but she's trained in Mexico. Her name is Mary Lou Ridinger. And she and her husband, Jay, did more than anything, really, to rediscover the lost jade mines. Mary Lou is the daughter of Betty Kempe, whom many of you may know, and the sister of Georgiann Johnson. So this second short piece I'm going to read is an adventure that Mary Lou and her husband Jay Ridinger had one day when they were prospecting for jade by helicopter. It was a hazy afternoon toward the end of the rainy season. We're now in Guatemala. It was a hazy afternoon toward the end of the rainy season. The Bell Jet Ranger helicopter hovered over the scrubby ridge. Sitting in the co-pilot's seat, Mary Lou Ridinger took her eyes away from the window and peered again at her map. Then she trained her binoculars on a stone outcrop several hundred feet below. Finally, she turned to Jay, sitting in the back seat beside his daughter Robin, and shouted over the thwack thwack of the blades, "That's the place." The Ridinger's prospecting was more sophisticated than it used to be. They were now expert with geological maps and could trace the fault lines and serpentinite deposits where jade was liable to lurk. The Ridingers were also more astute at recognizing jade when they found it. Because the stone wraps itself in a nondescript rind when exposed to the elements, appearances counted for little in this type of prospecting. The hunt was necessarily more tactile and oral, more intuitive. Over thousands of hours in the field, the Ridingers had mastered the language of the hammer bounce, had learned to parse its recoil and ping. Mary Lou was the ex-flying student, but it was Jay Ridinger who suggested they hire a helicopter despite the extraordinary expense. On the map, the area they were searching wasn't far from the site of their first jade discovery back in 1974, but it was much higher in the Sierra, up a sheer cliff with a waterfall, several days' walk from any road. The Ridingers knew because they had already hiked it. They had found some jade there, including a little of the coveted imperial green, but on foot, they'd been able to carry out only a few small samples, so they'd come back today in search of more. This morning they had spent reconnoitering another location, then had flown west to yet another place where they'd heard reports of jade. It was that second area they were flying over now. The sky was pocked with high thunderheads. As the helicopter skittered under the clouds, the Ridingers traced the corrugated contours on the ground. Mary Lou glanced at her map, then at the earth again. Yes, this was the spot. But if they set down, they would expend the little remaining daylight, and they wouldn't make it to where the Imperial Green was waiting. And since they weren't sure they could ever afford to hire another helicopter, they might never have the opportunity to return. Still, what if there were jade here as well? They were mulling the dilemma when Robin, now in her 20s, spoke up. Why didn't they drop her off to take a look? They could go on, then come back and pick her up later. Mary Lou and Jay hesitated. Not that they doubted her prospecting abilities. She was accomplished with a geologist's hammer and a vial of bromoform. But they were reluctant to let her down alone in strange territory. Robin pointed out that she often wandered off by herself when they were prospecting on foot. What was the difference? No campesinos or combatants came up this high in the Sierra. And the helicopter would be back in an hour anyway. What could possibly go wrong? Eventually, she persuaded them. Mary Lou signaled the pilot, a round and spectacled man named Ricardo, who brought the craft down on the ridge. Robin hopped out with her equipment bag and scurried from under the blades. As the helicopter took off, her parents could see her waving up at them. Mary Lou Ridinger held the map out to Ricardo and pointed to their next destination. He nodded, the helicopter turned to the east, and a few minutes later, they were circling the other site. They landed in a clearing and began chipping out some promising samples. But after an hour, they became aware of a dense fog forming around them. They grabbed their gear and jogged back to the helicopter. Ricardo started the rotors before they were even settled in their seats, and in a moment, they were racing toward Robin. In the short time it took to get there, the earth had vanished. Not even the flat tops of the mesquites and the acacias poked through the mist. It was impossible to get their bearings. And even if they could find the ridge again, landing was out of the question. They circled for a long time, but the weather only worsened. They were getting low on fuel, Ricardo told them. Finally, he said that if they didn't find Robin in 10 more minutes, they'd have to leave without her. Sitting alone in the back seat, Jay felt paralyzed at first. Then he remembered an ancient legend that if two people were wearing jade cut from the same boulder, they could communicate through the stone. Jay, Mary Lou, and Robin all wore plain pendants about the size of a half dollar, made from a single piece of green jade. Now, clutching his charm, Jay closed his eyes and focused fiercely on his daughter. After a few minutes, he pointed to a spot in the clouds and told Ricardo, "Go down there. She's going to be standing right down there." The pilot looked at him as if he were mad, but Ridinger insisted. The helicopter began a wary descent, with Ricardo watching the altimeter. And in that instant, the clouds parted just enough to reveal Robin, who was waving frantically and standing precisely where Jay had pointed. They sat down on top of the ridge, and Robin jumped in. Then as they rose, they glanced down at the place where they landed. It was totally consumed by fog again. At least, that's how Jay Ridinger told the story. The Ridingers never did get back to Guatemala City that afternoon. Out of fuel, they made an emergency landing in the parking lot of a Pepsi plant just east of Manzanal. Robin reported that her outcrop showed no sign of jade, but her parents had better luck. Based on the samples they took that day, they were able to expand their mining license to include that site as well. To extract the stone, they returned with burros, not a helicopter. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Next on our program is Zia Mayo. Zia Mayo is a travel writer, poet, and novelist. His most recent work is, actually this is not true, but we will correct it later on, is The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, a historical novel based on a true story of mid-19th century Mexico, named a best book of 2009 by Library Journal. The novel was widely launched as, in the words of the Austin American Statesman, a swashbuckling, riotous good time, befitting the fairy tale promise of the opening sentence. Nonetheless, it is based on extensive original archival research, and she has lectured widely about it at the Library of Congress, the Center of UX Mexican Studies, UCSD, the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, Austin, and elsewhere. Her previous book, Miraculous Air, is a travel memoir, rich with research and original interviews of Mexico's Baja California Peninsula from Los Cabos to Tijuana. Mayo's translations of Mexican contemporary literature have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, most recently Three Messages and a Warning, Contemporary Mexican Short Stories of the Fantastic, and Best Contemporary Mexican Fiction, as well as Mexico, a Traveler's Literary Companion. I think her most recent work, which is available online, but soon I hope to be available as a hard copy, is called The Spiritus Manual, and it's a translation. In 1911, the leader of Mexico's revolution of 1910, Francisco I. Madero, published a secret book under a pen name from the Bhagavad Gita, Bhima. This was the Manual Espirita, or Spiritus Manual, a frankly evangelical work which, given not only the subject matter, but Madero's position as a leading presidential candidate, was enormously threatening to the Catholic Church. Mexican historians Enrique Grace and others have written about Madero's spiritism and mediumship and their profound influence on his political decisions. Whatever one may think of spiritism, and I think the Sea of Maya will define that for us, Madero's Spiritus Manual is vital to understanding not only his actions, but the revolution of 1910 itself. I give you Sea of Maya.
Thank you so much, Eva. Thank you for that very warm and generous introduction, and also for everything you do for Soul Magazine and organizing this. And thank you all for coming. I'm really honored to be here, and a very warm thank you to Eva and Judith Hill, who helped out a lot, and Zina Kaufman and Elizabeth Starcevich. And well, I'm just very grateful that you made the effort to put this together, and I'm very honored to read together with Gerard, who I'm a big admirer of his work. And actually, I don't have time. If I had an hour, I'd read you a little bit from The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire. I'll have that for sale afterwards. If you want to pick up a copy, I'll be very happy to sign it. This is the novel. But what's fun about it is there's a little scene where my characters were reading Humboldt. He's the author of Humboldt's Cosmos. It was very influential, in fact, in Maximilian von Habsburg's decision to accept the crown of Mexico. And that is what my novel is about. But I'm going to talk to you today about something that's not mine. It's something I translated. A very strange book. One other person, whoops, I should mention before I get started, is Kelly Vandiver. I don't know if he's here, but I know a lot of you probably know him. He's an artist here with gallery at the Fabrica La Aurora. His amazing painting of a flower with an eye in it is on the cover of the book. And also on that little card I passed out. And I also passed out this one sheet to hopefully orient you as I go. The book, Spiritus Manual by Francisco Madero from 1911, with my translation, which came out in November, so it came out on its centennial, the first translation ever, is right now available as an ebook on Kindle. It will soon be an iBook, and hopefully very soon also, as Eva kindly said, hopefully also a hardcover. So if you want to get a copy, you're going to have to get it from Amazon.com. That said, even if you don't have a Kindle or the ebook thing just isn't your bag, I encourage you to come visit the website, which is cmao.com, Spiritus Manual, or you can just Google Spiritus Manual and you should get me. It has a lot of excerpts and the table of contents and a lot of other resources for researchers, because one of the points I'm going to make in my brief talk today is that I think this is a very essential book for trying to comprehend the revolution itself and Madero himself, as strange as it might seem to many people. So on the website, I have a lot of resources for researchers, a lot of bibliography, and so on and so forth. So anyway, the first thing that you'll see on this little handout is a picture of Don Francisco himself when he was president of Mexico. And the second one is a cover of the Manual Espírita itself from the archive. And where is the archive? Well, that's picture number 3 over on the right-hand side, Palacio Nacional, Mexico's National Palace, which is where the president, the presidency has its office, in addition to Los Pinos, of course. And also there are the offices of the Secretary of Treasury, of Hacienda. And within that is a museum to Benito Juarez, which is open to the public. And there is also the archive of Francisco Madero, which is also open to the public. So you can go in there and have a look yourself, and you will find in that archive many that book, the Manual Espírita, and also his channeled messages, because he was a medium. He was a writing medium, and the spirits told him, he wrote it down, that he had to start the revolution, and he had to run for president, and he had to do all sorts of things. And there it is. Completely there for you to see. Very interesting. The fourth thing that I'll mention on this little handout is a little clip from the Spirits book by Alan Kardec. That's over on the right-hand side. That's the most important work of literature on Spiritism. And down, let's see, at the very bottom in the middle is a little picture of table tipping. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. Part of the spiritualist and spiritist rituals was having seances where the spirits would tip the tables. In the lower left-hand corner, there's a Ouija board or something similar to that. They called it a planchette at that time. And then kind of in the middle, there's a picture of Hermes or Thoth, the Egyptian god. And then finally, in the bottom right-hand corner, there is an image from the Bhagavad Gita of Krishna. And these are all relevant to what this is about, and that's why they're on there. So what is the Spiritus Manual? What is this thing? It was at the behest of the Second Latin American Spiritist Congress, held in Mexico City in 1908, of which Maduro was a main organizer and patron. Maduro undertook to both write and publish a work aimed at converting presumably Catholic and literate, but not necessarily well-educated Mexicans to Spiritism. So in other words, the language is very simple, very direct. What is Spiritism? A doctrine imported from France in the latter half of the 19th century. Though he signed the preface in 1909, Maduro finished writing his Spiritus Manual in 1910, and it was published the following year, 1911. 5,000 copies were printed. In Mexico at that time, this represented a very substantial print run. Even today, 3,000 is a pretty big print run in Mexico. Maduro took his pen name Bhima, spelled B-H-I-M-A, from a warrior in the Hindu holy book, the Bhagavad Gita. In his correspondence with fellow spiritists, he urges that his identity as the author not be revealed. He was concerned that this proselytizing could undermine his political agenda in a time when, on the one hand, the Catholic Church, on the other, Mexico's intellectual elite, the so-called científicos, would have been hostile. In fact, they were hostile. They all knew who Maduro was, for under his real name, he was the author of a sensational book published in 1909 called La Sucesión Presidencial en 1910, The Presidential Succession in 1910, a polemic that literally launched the Mexican Revolution. Let me say that one more time. The Mexican Revolution was launched with a book. Okay, think about what that means. That is amazing. And just as an aside, if you want to read more about that, I think the easiest way to come into that is Enrique Krause's book on Maduro, which is still in print. It came out in the 80s. It's from Fondo de Cultura Económica. And you can also find it in Krause's English language tome, Biographies of Power. That entire book pretty much is reproduced as a chapter out of Maduro. Apart from its extraordinary content, and the fact that Maduro's Spiritus Manual is one of the earliest Spanish language manifestos of this new religion, what stands out about this work is that it was prepared precisely during the period when Maduro's political career was rocketing to its apex. He was campaigning throughout the country for the Mexican presidency, then fighting the Mexican Revolution, both in Mexico and variously from exile in Texas and New Orleans. And by the way, he spent his time in New Orleans largely in public library reading the Bhagavad Gita. And then running again for the presidency, which later in 1911 he was to win. As Mexican historians Enrique Krause, Yolia Tortolero, Alejandro Rosas, and Manuel Guerra, among others, have emphasized, Maduro's spiritism undergirded his political philosophy and actions as candidate for the presidency, as leader of the revolution, and as president, many of which were incomprehensible to and were misinterpreted by both his supporters and his adversaries. For this reason, the Spiritus Manual is a fundamentally important work for anyone who would study Maduro and the Mexican Revolution. It's also a vital work in the history of both Spiritism itself and modern Gnostic Christianity. Whatever your personal beliefs may be, I would argue that it would be intellectually naive to dismiss it as mere superstition, as most people who first heard it, and indeed most of his biographers do. Spiritism emerged in the context of the mid to late 19th centuries far-reaching scientific experimentation. Moreover, it has its place alongside other religions that emerged in the same century, among them Christian Science, Mormonism, Spiritualism, and Theosophy. The doctrine of Spiritism. I have to admit, I had actually done a lot of reading on fairly esoteric subjects, and so I thought this was going to be pretty easy to translate, but I was not familiar with Spiritism. What I knew was Spiritualism, which is a little different, and most English language, English speakers coming from an Anglo-American tradition have heard of Spiritualism. Spiritism's a little bit different. The doctrine of Spiritism was formulated by Allan Kardec. He was born in 1804 and died in 1869, and that is who you see on the little handout on the far right-hand side of the Book of the Spirits. He was a French educator, and in his several books, among them the Book of the Spirits from 1857 and the Medium's Book from 1861, he was inspired by American spiritualism, the UA, or spiritualism. But these Kardec's books are based on his own extensive interviews with spirits who purportedly communicated with him through French mediums. And these interviews led him to conclude, departing from the American spiritualists at that time, that spirits reincarnate in life after life as they evolve into greater states of consciousness. So spiritualists at that time did not espouse reincarnation, but spiritists did. According to his adherents, Spiritism is at once a science, a philosophy, and a religion. The science examines the nature of spirits and the invisible world, while the philosophy, among other things, holds that humanity evolves through multiple reincarnations, and the religion presented in Christian terms, Jesus Christ as, to quote Kardec, the epitome of the moral perfection to which humanity can aspire on earth, that the universe is a creation of a loving God. A slender book of less than 100 pages, Majoris Spiritus Manual, is firmly in the tradition of Kardec's works. However, it incorporates ideas from more contemporary Spiritists, because Madero was writing more than 50 years later. He cites various writers and scientists in the Spiritist, Spiritualist, and Theosophist traditions, as well as ideas from Hinduism and the Hermetica, the ancient Egyptian philosophy of Thoth, or Hermes, a mythological sage god whose writings were preserved through fragments of Greek translations and brought into Western culture during the Renaissance. I should also mention here that he was very influenced by Edouard Chouret, who was a French writer with a book that's still in print in many languages called The Great Initiates. And Chouret was a contemporary of Rudolf Steiner, the founder of the Waldorf schools and anthroposophy. And he was also a big friend of Wagner, the composer, and Nietzsche. So the book, Madero's book, is divided into six sections. First, a brief overview of the doctrine of Spiritism, some historical background covering the divine missionaries, Krishna, Hermes, Moses, and Jesus, and that is mostly straight out of Edouard Chouret. And the Spiritist revelations, which began with the phenomenon of table tipping earlier in the 19th century, first in upstate New York, of all places. It began in upstate New York and later in Europe. The third section examines mental and spiritist phenomena. A fourth, the philosophical, covers spiritist theories of the perispirit, astral projection, which is out of body travel, phantoms, mechanical or automatic writing, in other words, just writing mediums, receiving, channeling that they just channel into their hands, apparitions, reincarnations, and God, and finally, morality. The section on morality being the key chapter, I think, for anyone who wants to understand him as a political actor. He really makes it very clear why, if you are a good person, you're going to be a Spiritist, and if you're a good Spiritist, you're going to be a Democrat. You're going to want to go vote. and then finally, he supplies a summary. So that is the nature of the book. It's a really strange book, I have to say. The process of translating it, I just offered to translate it when I saw it because I had just come out of writing my novel, which is based on the French intervention in Mexico's Second Empire during the 1860s. And in doing all that research, much of which was archival, I really came to deeply appreciate how many vital works are not translated. And once you translate them, let's say from the German or from the French or into Spanish or into English, it changes completely how people think about and write about something. And because these kinds of things, you know, there's usually not somebody handing out money saying, please go translate those. It's really something that you, as someone going through the archives, find, and just out of the, you just feel moved to do it, and so you do it. And if later you can publish it and make a few pennies, that's great. But you really, it's really a labor of love, of understanding the need to have it translated. And so when I saw this book, The Spirit is Manual, when I happened to have a tour, I was just like being a tourist, having a tour of the archive, I saw it and I said, has anyone translated that? No. And I thought, well, I'll do it. And they're like, why did I say that? Okay, but I did. And I thought it would be easy. It's not a very big book. And I've done a lot of literary translation, and it's not literary, so I thought I could do it in a few weekends. But it turned out that I really needed to understand the context that it came from. And so I had to do an awful lot of reading on spiritism and spiritualism and theosophy and hermetica and a lot of really way out stuff that I just wouldn't have thought to read about. And it was really an education for me to be able to come in then and put it in some kind of context. One of the questions that I always get is, why is this book not available? Why is it that it took 100 years for somebody to translate it into English? And a related question, can we find it in Spanish? It did come out in the 70s in an edition that I have not been able to find. So if you want to find the original, you're going to have to go to the archive. That may change at any moment, however. I recently was on archive.org, which has a lot of out-of-copyright works, and I found his Sucesión Presidencial en 1910, his presidential succession book. I found it on there. So maybe when you check, someone will have gotten at this Spiritus Manual. But right now, 2012, there are works about it, but they're pretty tough to find, and it's tough to find the actual book. Why is that? I think there are several reasons, but most importantly, with a very few notable exceptions, historians have steered far clear of Madura Spiritism because there's an expression in Mexico which I really like, which is called the ñañeras. Ñañeras. It's like creepy. It creeps them out. And then there's a fancy term for the source of this discomfort, which is cognitive dissonance. Here they are studying an educated man who, in the name of justice and democracy, successfully overthrew a dictatorship. He was elected president of Mexico. And yet who of sound mind dares to admit they believe in invisible beings, tables tipping without human agency, and that they can hear messages from the beyond? These days, most people who hear voices telling them they have a great destiny end up in a hospital where they are dosed with some pretty heavy-duty pharmaceuticals. It's well documented that Madura claimed he channeled messages from spirits whom he believed advised him at many critical turns in his comet-like political career. In his determination to unleash a revolution in 1910, he was also profoundly influenced by the Hindu holy book, the Bhagavad Gita. So I'm going to skip over all of this. But also that I think just mentioning the Bhagavad Gita, just mentioning a Hindu holy book in most Mexican leading social and intellectual circles at that time would have been enormously threatening and bizarre. Okay? Not surprisingly, at the first wind of Spiritism, the Pope slapped all of Kardec's works on the Vatican's list of prohibited books, and the Church openly said the seance, which is a key ritual of Spiritism and spiritualism, the seance is communing with the devil. Okay, so it was kind of difficult where most people were Catholic and the Church was very powerful to espouse Spiritism. It just makes people hugely uncomfortable. So what I'm saying is that for most of those who would celebrate Madura's heroic service to the nation, and it was heroic, it really was, this esoteric business was and is even today, for many people, a hobgoblin to keep inside a well-bolted cupboard. That said, just a brief note before I conclude. Jose Juan Tablada's 1910 play, Madero Chanticleer, portrayed Madero invoking spirits. It did cause some uproar. And during his presidency, which ended with his murder in 1913, during his presidency, newspapers did relish printing caricatures of him as a medium. It was like a sort of a big rumor, gossip, that most people refused to believe. Or if they knew it was true, they were very aggressive in saying how terrible this was, that he was a spiritism. So for decades after his death in Mexico, the, quote, apostle of democracies, spiritism, was still spoken of in whispers as chisme or gossip. Not until 1960, nearly half a century after Madero's death, with José Valadez's Imagen y Realidad de Francisco Madero, or Madero Image and Reality, was a collection of documents and an overview of Madero's spiritist activities made in print. In 1973, José Natividad Rosales published a slender paperback of his letters and some of his channelings aimed at the mass market. And in 78, as I mentioned, Gustavo de Anda reprinted the Manual Espírita, but I've been looking for it for 3 years now and I haven't been able to find it anywhere. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, I just can't find it. Nonetheless, the fact is 7 decades had passed before any major Mexican historian addressed Madero's spiritism in depth and seriousness, and that was Enrique Krause with Madero Místico de la Libertad in 1987, which I mentioned to you. There's an awful lot more about this with a lot of Q&A, extensive A to the Q, on the website, where I go into some of the movies that have been made and Ignacio Solares' novels, Madero, El Otro, and some other things of that nature. But it really is astonishing that such a major figure has a major work that is just so difficult to find and is untranslated. So I felt it was important to bring it forth, and it was very satisfying to do so. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you very much.
We have a couple of minutes if there are any questions, either for Gerard or Sam. Maya, okay, Elizabeth?
I wanted to ask about the knowledge of Madame Blavatsky in relation to
Latin America,
because I did some work on some of the intellectuals in Spain, and there was a large spiritual movement influenced by Blavatsky, so I'm just wondering whether there were any kind of crossover.
Madame Blavatsky is a major figure, founder of Theosophy, a really layout character. I'm reading about her was just eye-crossing. I have the impression that Madero mostly took his ideas from French literature. But that said, I guess if you were a sociologist looking at the scene around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, there's an awful lot of overlap of people coming, you know, who are associated with Theosophy, the whole Madame Blavatsky thing, and Rudolf Steiner coming into the early 20th century, and then, of course, Spiritism, French, and Spiritualism, and there's just kind of a lot of this and that all over the place. So at some point, it becomes difficult to really categorize people, but my clear impression of Madero was that he was a student in France, you know, a niño bien who went to study in France, and he just pretty much picked it up from France and took it with him. That's pretty much the impression that I had. It was really a French focus. But that said, we know that he spoke English and he read in English, and he, in fact, spent a lot of time at the New Orleans Public Library taking notes on the Bhagavad Gita. So he may well have read Madame Blavatsky at some point. These books were, you know, sold very well at that time. But specifically, I couldn't be more specific at this point.
What's the question back here?
Question for Gerard. How did the Mayans cut jade?
With great difficulty. Jade is one of the hardest minerals that there is, one of the hardest stones. And so in order to cut it, they needed something at least as hard as the jade itself. Sometimes they used jade, other pieces of jade. So, often they used garnets. In the Motagua River in Guatemala, there are garnets in the riverbed. And they would take them, and since they're very hard, they would shatter. So they would grind them down to a powder as fine as talcum powder. And then they would take often a wooden implement, and they would put grease on it. For instance, if they wanted to saw a plaque, like slicing a loaf from a loaf of bread. They would take a piece of wood, dip it in rendered fat. They would dip it in the powdered garnets, and then they would start sawing. And when they got to the middle, after maybe weeks of work, depending on the size of this thing, they'd turn it over, and they'd start sawing the other way. And then when it got, when there was a little curve just as big in the middle, they would snap it off. And they had similar techniques to make holes, like for instance, for the hang of tendon. They would take a hollow bird's bone, they would dip it in fat, and then in garnets, and they would turn it with either by hand or with a bow, and it would cut a circle. But it was, because jade is so hard, which is one of the things that made it valuable, it was extremely difficult. Now jade is worked with diamond-tipped implements. Of course, they didn't have that.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
Margie.
For Jerry. How long did it take you to do the research for the Humboldt Cosmos and Stone Kings?
It was probably about 2 years, I would guess, more or less, counting writing the proposal and finding a publisher and writing it and doing the research. I do research and write at the same time. Some writers like to do all the research and then start writing. I can't do that. I like to write and the information is still fresh in my head. But each book has taken me about 2 years. And I suspect the Roosevelt book will probably get close to that.
Well, I see that you sort of came to your own conclusions. Like, did that just develop as you were writing, or did you already have that?
I didn't really know what the conclusion of, I mean, I had an idea what the conclusion of the mystery is going to be, but as I went along, I discovered some nuances in that. And it was really helpful that I had a lot of help from geologists and archaeologists who were very generous with their time. They would let me interview them and visit them and read the manuscript, and they really helped to guide me through the process. So that conclusion in the book is really, it's not mine in the sense that it's original to me. It's what I distilled from everything that everybody told me over the course of doing the book.
Okay, thank you. CMIO and Gerard Helfferich.